Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks, offering cool climate wines that capture the essence of Oregon since 2002. In this episode, we feature poet and memoirist Tracy K. Smith. Smith is the author of three collections of poetry, the third of which, Life on Mars, won the Pulitzer Prize. In 2015, she published the memoir Ordinary Light, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Smith spoke in Portland on February 16, 2017, as part of our Portland Arts and Lecture series, and I cannot imagine a more relevant talk given the political environment we find ourselves in today. Near the beginning of her talk, Smith says, quote, "Sloppy, imprecise language fosters sloppy, imprecise thinking, and it's a vicious downward spiral. Our shoddy thinking deadens us further to the dangers of vague, senseless, or deliberately false language." Smith delves into a passionate defense of precise language and how it fosters strong and nuanced thinking. Her talk is, of course, both directly and indirectly political, drawing on sources as disparate as George Orwell, Emily Dickinson, Federico Garcia Lorca, Ya Jesse, and Seamus Heaney. She interweaves her own poems near the end, and they make for a beautiful conclusion. As a person who loves books and words, and who sometimes feels powerless in the face of so much of what goes on in the world, I found her talk empowering and fortifying, because she reminded me just how much the words you choose to use shape the world we live in. Here's Smith.
Thank you. Good evening. This is my first time in Portland. Yes. It's just been a really wonderful day. There's such a wonderful sense of community that I've witnessed here with students and with writers and just with the sense of enthusiasm for art and language. And so I feel really privileged to be in your company tonight, especially at a time when the world feels like it needs this kind of community more and more. I find myself thinking a lot these days of George Orwell. Apparently, I'm not alone. I think everybody's got Orwell on the brain. As you probably know, the novel 1984 has become an international bestseller in the last 3 weeks. But what returns to me again and again is Orwell's brilliant essay, Politics and the English Language, which argues that sloppy, imprecise language fosters sloppy, imprecise thinking, and it's a vicious downward spiral. Our shoddy thinking deadens us further to the dangers of vague, senseless, or deliberately false language. The end game, as Orwell sees it, is quite harrowing. To allow one's thoughts to be corrupted by ready-made phrases, dead metaphors, deliberate obfuscations, and the like is to become more vulnerable to political conformity. I'm going to give you two quotes from the essay, and then I promise that's it with Orwell. He writes, "Political language, and with variations, this is true of all political parties, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind." And in our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face and which do not square with the professed aims of the political parties. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air. the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine gunned, the hut set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of population, or rectification of frontiers. People are imprisoned for years without trial, or shot in the back of the neck and sent to die of scurvy in Arctic lumber camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them. I think Orwell is quite good at speaking for himself, so I won't go on about the essay, other than to say that if you haven't read it lately, now would be a good time. And I bring it up now simply because it gets to what sits at the core of what I see as literature's role in both private and public life. I think it also helps me to come clean about some of my own anxieties as a citizen of the 21st century, and to think about why our position as readers and writers continues to be so crucial, not just to the survival of individual inner life, but to the viability of our culture. The very first poem that spoke to me when I was a fifth grader nosing through an English textbook is this poem by Emily Dickinson. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog. I liked the sense of mischievous collusion that poem fostered, and the sense of privacy it seemed to urge, as if there was some part of myself worth protecting from the world. That was my first sense of what a poem could activate or foster, and I was hooked. 15 years later, I encountered Seamus Heaney's great poem, Digging, which is the first poem in his first collection, and I found myself awakened to that same feeling of immediate intimacy with an absolute stranger. I'm going to read that poem because I love it so much, and I also love the spirit of Seamus Heaney, who was such a generous and joyful and also serious presence, someone serious about the word and what it can bring into being. Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father, digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once, I carried him milk in a bottle corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf. Digging. The cold smell of potato mold, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. I remember reading that poem and feeling like a feat of magic had been performed. You know, that opening image, which is so powerful, of the pen snug as a gun. By the time we've moved through the recollection of place and experience becomes itself and also something larger. And I thought, wow, what a poem can do is look at the world at hand until it becomes newly strange and newly useful. As a 20-year-old who was powerless, really, in my life, that ability that a poem offered me felt like a huge gift. With Heaney, this sense of identification also drew me into a state of familiarity with a landscape and a lineage that had ostensibly nothing to do with me, Northern Ireland during the Troubles, where a young writer's sense of political avocation finds outlet not on the front lines of revolution, but at his desk, on the page. Maybe these two poems straddle the poles of inner life and participation in the life or the survival of a collective culture. For Dickinson, the concern is for the freedom and the privacy to be an individual, an iconoclast, a person against the grain, to claim a sense of invisibility within which the vitality of an inner life can be nurtured. For Heaney, the concern is the realization that a commitment to language can conjure and preserve a collective sense of place and legacy, despite time, loss, change, and that such an act can be tantamount to political action. I think the success of both of those poems and of any poem really relies upon creating a palpable sense of encounter with the reader, creating a discernible mindset, a mood, a time, and a place where the poem's speaker and its reader might meet. A good poem does that in a way that feels real, that gives you something to take away with you and keep, the pen between the fingers, something that changes the world moving forward for you. The clean, rasping sound when the blade sinks into gravelly ground, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots. It's hard not to come away from a poem like Digging feeling that you too have worked the Irish countryside, felt that soil and all of that hangs upon it in your hands. As a reader, these kinds of encounters have changed and I think enlarged my sense of the world. They've deepened my place within it. They've taught me what to look for, what to remember, what to revere. They tell me it's not so very strange to feel conflicted by the understanding of home as both political territory and the site of private markers of family, memory, tradition. These kinds of encounters also create a sense of investment in places and lives separated from me by time or geography and culture. Most importantly, they foster empathy and humility and curiosity. They assure me that my perspective and my certainties are matched by countless others, all richly complex and worth consideration and sometimes even deference. Think about how much in our culture exists to call such assertions into question. How much is predicated upon making the complex lives that surround us seem flat, cheap, devoid of depth, and unworthy of consideration. Bad hombres, radical Islamic terrorists, or, more benignly, swipe left, swipe right, click here, forget about all that, think instead of your own needs and comforts and appetites. All the sales pitches and shorthand mnemonics that make other people's lives little more than threats or punchlines and distractions. To return briefly to Orwell, the language of literature has never been about pacification. It is about urging us to recognize the peasants marching along the roads, the people detained and imprisoned without a trial, the villagers bombarded by planes, and of course, It is also about the comfortable and conflicted, the guilty, the unsuspecting, the remorseless. Most importantly, literature is about facilitating the necessary realization that we are not so very different from those we pity and those we abhor. I wish everyone in America were required to read a dozen literary novels and a dozen books of poetry every year. Yeah. Not just to read them, but to live with them, reflect upon them, to recognize themselves within those stories and those conflicts. Perhaps some already do. I'd wager, though, that many aren't yet comfortable with that degree of nuance. Yet, how could you take in a novel like Yah Jesse's Homegoing, in which you find myriad passages like the one I'm about to read, and not feel a sense of social conviction that puts party line dogma and jargon about the other to shame? This is a novel, in case you haven't read it, that very elegantly chronicles two sides of a single family. One line that is born in West Africa and remains there throughout the slave trade and into the present time. And one line that is born there and sold into slavery and brought to this country. And the novel kind of miraculously moves through 300 years of history by looking at one member of each generation on each side of the Atlantic, chapter by chapter, and it brings you to the present. And the result is this really stunning sense of a through line in all of this history, a single story and a single kind of choice that we are still living with. This is a passage from late in the book that focuses on one of the, like a contemporary descendant of this family named Sonny. Originally, he'd wanted to focus his work on the convict leasing system that had stolen years off of his great-grandpa H's life. But the deeper into the research he got, the bigger the project got. How could he talk about great-grandpa H's story without also talking about his grandma Willie and the millions of other black people who had migrated north, fleeing Jim Crow? And if he mentioned the Great Migration, he'd have to talk about the cities that took the flock in. He'd have to talk about Harlem. And how could he talk about Harlem without mentioning his father's heroin addiction, the stints in prison, the criminal record? And if he was going to talk about heroin in Harlem in the 60s, wouldn't he also have to talk about crack everywhere in the 80s? And if he wrote about crack, he'd inevitably be writing, too, about the war on drugs. And if he started talking about the war on drugs, he'd be talking about how nearly half of the black men he grew up with were on their way either into or out of what had become the harshest prison system in the world. And if he talked about why friends from his hood were doing five-year bids for possession of marijuana when nearly all the white people he'd gone to college with smoked it openly every day, he'd get so angry that he'd slam the research book on the table of the beautiful but deadly silent Lane reading room of Green Library of Stanford University. And if he slammed the book down, then everyone in the room would stare, and all they would see would be his skin and his anger, and they'd think they knew something about him. And how could you, as a reader, take in the passionate devotion to elegizing and elegizing the lost and reclaiming the surrendered that runs through Somaz Sharif's magnificent collection Look? In one of the poems called Personal Effects, which is a 31-page poem for the poet's uncle killed in the Iran-Iraq War, the poem draws us into the sense of place and what is lost or surrendered when someone migrates out of necessity, and the various versions of the story that obliterate intimacy and vulnerability in the lives of people on the ground in conflict. This is a five-line excerpt from a poem, Personal Effects. and I place in his hands his head. And I place in his hands my hands. And I place in his eyes a look we share in the rear view. And I place between us a bar of laughter. And I place between us the looking and the telling they want dead. If you're here tonight, though, it's probably because you already agree with this, already believe that literature is an urgently necessary alternative to the glib, facile, simplistic, and prefabricated language by which we as consumers are constantly surrounded and with which we are continually bombarded. You may already have grown weary of the ego-pandering ploys of corporations to convince us that our opinions are most valuable when they are in service of our expertise as consumers, and increasingly, to convince us that what we are getting is worth what we are giving away. As a writer, I'm convinced that the only defense against the degradations of our market-driven culture and our increasingly vulnerable political process is to cleave to language that fosters humility, awareness of complexity, commitment to the lives of others, and a resistance to the overly easy and the patently false. And at the risk of coming up short against the marvelous writers I've already invoked, I'd like to share some excerpts of my own work and the writing of which has helped deepen my commitment to these principles, and maybe also talk a little bit about the process and the struggle by which some of these poems came about. When I was a student of creative writing, I remember reading a lecture that the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca gave in Argentina, in which he describes the duende, which in Andalusia, where he came from, is considered to be like the dark, unpredictable, dangerous and lively energy that comes from inside of the artist, and that somebody who might be, say, performing the cante hondo, deep song, or dancing flamenco is drawing up and out into the room. When I talk about this, I always point to my belly because I feel like that's where this energy kind of swirls around. He describes it as something that's dangerous because it can undo you. He says that the duende only comes around when death or failure is a possibility, and that it's miraculous to witness an artist who's willing to abandon a sense of virtuosity and go to this other raw, real place and come through that. I loved that concept in aesthetic terms for years and years before it made any local sense to me. And then there came this moment right around the time my first book was coming out when I went to Spain, and I went to see some of these performances. As somebody who had spent a lot of time traveling in Mexico, I felt a little bit conflicted about going to the colonial, culture. But what I realized was that there were some really marvelous similarities between different forms on these two continents. And what really struck me was the way that the people who were responsible for these art forms, things that sometimes get relegated to the realm of like folk tradition, when really they're arts, are often people who live in a kind of a social margin. And then I started thinking, well, if you live in a social margin, this idea of struggling against something that could be your real undoing, it's not just an artistic preoccupation, it's something that you might be dealing with day to day in real time, in contact with a language that seeks to absorb your language, or a culture that seeks to negate your right to occupy space. That is when this concept became really exciting to me, and when I felt like I could recognize parallels in my own life, in other forms, and in just the nature of survival. I think that that revelation or that realization made me feel like what I was hoping to do as an artist was not just about making beautiful things, but surviving and bearing the weight of, you know, life, love, loss, divorce, political anxiety. So my book that takes Duende as its title was really like in search of all of these different examples of surviving this other dark force that comes sometimes from within and sometimes it comes at you from without. I want to read one poem from that book that I think is, as I imagine it, an example of like domestic Duende. And then an excerpt from a poem that's thinking about survival in a different context, a kind of the context of political conflict. Slow burn. We tend toward the danger at the center, soft core teeming blue with fire. We tend toward what will singe and flare, but coil back when brought near. Sometimes we read about people pushed there and left to recover. They don't come out mangled or not at all, minds flayed by visions no one can fathom. I have a cousin who haunts the basement of my aunt's house, drinking her liquor. The air around him is cold, and he swings at it, working himself into a sweat like a boxer or an addict. Sometimes he comes upstairs to eat her food, feeding the thing inside him. We laugh, thinking laughter will make us safe. Then we go home and lie down in our lives. Sometimes when my thoughts won't sit still, I imagine Marcus down there, awake in the dark, hands fisted in his lap or upturned, open in what might be a kind of prayer. I'm certain the same thing dragging his heart drags ours, only he's not afraid to name it, can call it up into the room and swear at it, or let it rest there on the couch beside him till his head slumps onto his chest and the TV bruises the walls with unearthly light. About 12 years ago, I guess I read an article in the New York Times Magazine about a group of young women in Uganda who had been abducted by members of a group called the Lord's Resistance Army that was led by Joseph Kony. And they were taken out of their high school and brought to this rebel soldier camp where they were forced to marry soldiers, bear their children, and commit a lot of these heinous war crimes, often against their own community. And I was really ashamed that I hadn't heard anything about this. I had never read or heard anything about this conflict. I don't think it's possible to make amends for that kind of ignorance, but I wanted to try and do that by kind of living a little bit longer with these voices. And I wanted to educate myself a little bit about the conflict by thinking about some of the other players within it. And so what I did, which is what I usually do when I have this wish to come into contact with something that is, you know, remote in some ways from me, was to write a poem. And this poem, because I was so taken by the voices of these young women, became a play, like a short play. The names of the women are Charlotte Awino, Grace Akan, Janet Akelo, and Caroline Anyango. And what was really remarkable to me was that after a certain point, after having been, you know, for years captive, they managed to escape and go home. And they also managed to find a way of forgiving themselves for all of the things that they had done. And that also seemed like this huge miracle. And so this is I'm going to read you just the end of the poem, in which they kind of speak from the other side of this experience. Some of the language comes directly from their quotes in the article. The poem is called Into the Moonless Night. Janet. I beat a 10-year-old boy to death. Blood came from his ears and nose. I was ordered to beat him with a big stick. I liked him. He looked me in the face as he died. President Museveni. We have a country to run. They have Holy Spirit mystic nonsense. We have helicopters, tanks, trucks. They have ragtag children, guerrilla girls. Grace. After an army attack, I found my son's shirt and his arm in a tree. Caroline. There was a kind of comfort in the other women, lost girls surviving by the smallest acts. The ones who lasted were strong. The ones who didn't were some of the best of us, would have become something valuable in another place. Janet, why did I love life? And if I loved it, why didn't I lose it? Chorus. Now, please tell us, how does it end? Grace, does it end? Charlotte, somewhere in every life, there is a line, one side to the other, and you are gone. Not disappeared, but undone. Janet, what time does not heal, it destroys. I beat a rug, and my own body stiffens with the memory. Grace, come. We girls are not supposed to be out after dark. So sometime I was talking to some students today and other writers, and one thing we didn't really talk about was like writer's block, and the silence comes up when you maybe don't know how to say something. I have become really receptive in those times to assignments, things like I give my students, which they miraculously complete every week with real poems. And every now and then, I've been asked or invited to do writing that I wouldn't normally do. A few years back, the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War was acknowledged by the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C., by an exhibit of Civil War photos, and also this volume of poems on the war by a dozen or so different poets. There were no real parameters that we were given other than that we were supposed to write poems about the Civil War. That was material that I would never have thought of approaching. Not that I don't think it was important, but I didn't have a point of access. I think my view of people who are talking about the Civil War was kind of shaped by reenactments and something that made me like really deeply uncomfortable. But I thought that there must be another way of coming into contact with other of the lives that were shaped by that conflict. And in researching, I found something that was so just troubling. A series of letters that African American soldiers and their family members had written to Abraham Lincoln, asking for help in getting their pension, asking for advice as to whether or not they were or weren't free, asking for help in finding their family members who had been sold to other parts of the country. And more than making me want to speak about the conflict, I really just wanted to curate some of these voices, bring them together, and again, almost in the same way that poem that I just read did, bring a kind of a chorus into being and to live with the music and the cacophony of those voices. Another huge part of the reading that I did was to look at excerpts from depositions. So as you know, soldiers are entitled to a pension, but people who had been enslaved before or during the war did not have birth certificates. They didn't have marriage licenses. They didn't have proof of identification. Often their names after slavery were different from the names that they had been given during slavery. And so they spent years trying to chase down these pensions. Sometimes that hunt was passed down to their widows and their descendants. And that was awful to read. And again, I just wanted to bring some of these voices, this very straightforward set of requests together and feel the force of that. So I'm going to read you two excerpts from the poem that are kind of these choruses of multitude of voices. Excellent sir, my son went into the 54th Regiment. Sir, my husband, who is in Company K, 22nd Regiment, U.S. Colored Troops, and now in the Macon Hospital at Portsmouth with a wound in his arm, has not received any pay since last May, and then only $13. Sir, we, the members of Company D of the 55th Massachusetts Volunteers, call the attention of Your Excellency to our case. For instance, look and see that we never was freed yet, run right out of slavery into soldiery, and we hadn't nothing at all, and our wives and mothers, most all of them, is a perishing all about, and we are perishing ourselves. I am willing to be a soldier and serve my time faithful like a man, but I think it is hard to be put off in such doggish manner as that. Will you see that the colored men fighting now are fairly treated? You ought to do this, and do it at once. Not let the thing run along. Meet it quickly, manfully. We poor oppressed ones appeal to you and ask fair play. So please, if you can do any good for us, do it in the name of God. Excuse my boldness, but please, your reply will settle the matter and be appreciated by a colored man who is willing to sacrifice his son in the cause of freedom and humanity. I have nothing more to say, hoping that you will lend a listening ear to an humble soldier. I will close, yours for Christ's sake. I shall have to send this without a stamp, for I ain't money enough to buy a stamp. I am 60-odd years of age. I am 62 years of age next month. I am about 65 years of age. I reckon I'm about 67 years old. I'm about 68 years of age. I am on the rise of 80 years of age. I am 89 years old. I am 94 years of age. I don't know my exact age. I am the claimant in this case. I have testified before you two different times before. I filed my claim, I think, first about 12 years ago. I am now an applicant for a pension because I understand that all soldiers are entitled to a pension. I claim pension under the general law on account of disease of eyes as a result of smallpox contracted in service. The varicose veins came on both my legs soon after the war, and the sores were there when I first put in my claim. I claim pension for rheumatism and got my toe broke, and I was struck in the side with the breech of a gun, breaking my ribs. I was a man stout and healthy, over 27 years of age when I enlisted. When I enlisted, I had a little mustache and some chin whiskers. I was just a green boy right off the farm and did just what I was told to do. When I went to enlist, the recruiting officer said to me, "Your name is John Wilson." I said, "No, my name is Robert Harrison," but he put me down as John Wilson. I was known while in service by that name. I cannot read nor write, and I do not know how my name was spelled when I enlisted, nor do I know how it is spelled now. I always sign my name while in the Army by making my mark. I know my name by sound. My mother said after my discharge that the reason the officer put my name down as John Wilson was he could draw my bounty. I am the son of Solomon and Lucinda Sibley. I am the only living child of Dennis Campbell. My father was George Jordan, and my mother was Millie Jordan. My mother told me that John Barnett was my father. My mother was Mary Eliza Jackson, and my father, Reuben Jackson. My name on the roll was Frank Nunn. No, sir, it was not Frank Nern. My full name is Dick Lewis Barnett. I am the applicant for pension on account of having served under the name Lewis Smith, which was the name I wore before the days of slavery were over. My correct name is Hiram Kirkland. Some persons call me Harry, and others call me Henry, but neither is my correct name. I feel, maybe you feel this way too. I used to imagine that 150 years, say, between, you know, the time when this poem was written and the time period that it's considering, felt like such a long stretch of time. Those old sepia images, or even those black and white newsreels from the civil rights movement in the 50s. And now I feel the distance has gotten shorter and shorter, and I feel like we are fighting for some of the very same things that seem to have been resolved. And that really scares me. I don't know that a poem or even a novel can change that. But I feel like it puts us in a position of mindfulness, a position where we're receptive to the pangs of those kinds of realizations, and maybe where we're willing to do something that we aren't normally willing to do, which is not make excuses. Maybe that's what I feel is so valuable also. I want to read a poem that comes out of the Black Lives Matter movement because it feels so so close to that other history, alarmingly. You may remember a beautiful photograph that emerged from some of the protests this past summer of a woman in the street in Baton Rouge in a sundress that's kind of gauzily blowing in the wind, and she's facing down a group of police officers in riot gear. That's an image taken by a photojournalist named Jonathan Bachman. And I was asked to kind of write a poem about that, another one of these assignments that I very greedily took out of the wish to kind of like think differently. And the sensibility that that poem imparted was one that had to do with love and not just the beautiful kind of like embracing, forgiving notion of love, but the idea that love is something that's so dangerous we are sometimes willing to do anything to defend ourselves from it. And that seems so so surprising and so true also. This is a poem called Unrest in Baton Rouge. Our bodies run with ink-dark blood. Blood pools in the pavement's seams. Is it strange to say love is a language few practice, but all or near all speak? Even the men in black armor, the ones jangling handcuffs and keys, what else are they so buffered against if not love's blade sizing up the heart's familiar meat? We watch and grieve. We sleep, stir, eat. Love, the heart sliced open, gutted, clean. Love, naked almost in the everlasting street, skirt lifted by a different kind of breeze. Thank you. I really do believe that all of this makes us better people, like being able to sort of step out of the necessities of our lives and return to a largeness of self that language helps to remind us of or activate. I also know that as a writer, I feel like I'm my best self when I'm in my study at my desk doing that work, deciding that love is, you know, this bounty and also a kind of, I don't know, weapon almost. And then time comes and I have to leave that room and go back into my house, and there are kids jumping on furniture and, you know, things piling up. And I realize that I'm just a messed up person who's, you know, angry and sloppy and helpless. And I don't really know how to deal with those two realities. I guess it's just humbling or something to have to recognize that, the disparity between these versions of the self. So maybe I'll close with two poems that are thinking about these two views of me. And this poem that I'm about to read is triggered by a really wonderful poem called The Cup by the poet C.K. Williams, who sadly passed away about a year and a half ago. And it was an assignment I gave my students. They had to look at the poem, which is really funny. It's written from the perspective of an adult who's trying to figure out what was going on in his head when he was an adolescent and so mad at his mother, and would wake up in the morning and see her drink her coffee, this poor woman, and just think she was a beast. And so this is a poem that's borrowing this kind of self-scrutiny and also this deep, over-the-top observation of somebody else. Dusk. What woke to war in me those years when my daughter had first grown into a solid, self-centered self? I'd watch her sit at the table. Well, not quite sit. More like stand on one leg while the other knee hovered just over the chair. She wouldn't lower herself, as if there might be a fire or a great black blizzard of waves let loose in the kitchen, and she'd need to make her escape. No, she'd trust no one but herself, her own new, lean, always jittering legs to carry her. Where exactly? Where would a child go? To there. There alone. She'd rest one elbow on the table, the opposite one to the bent leg, skimming the solid, expensive, tasteful chair. And even though we were together, her eyes would go half-dome, shades dropped like a screen at some cinema the old aren't let into. I thought I'd have more time. I thought my body would have taken longer going about the inevitable feat of repelling her. But now I could see even in what food she left untouched, the food I'd bought and made and all but ferried to her lips, I could see how it smacked of all that had grown slack and loose in me. Her other arm would wave the fork around just above the surface of the plate, casting about for the least possible morsel, the tiniest grain of unseasoned rice. She'd dip into the food like one of those shoddy metal claws poised over a valley of rubber bouncing balls, the kind that lifts nothing or next to nothing and drops it in the chute. The narrow, untouched hips, the shoulders still so naive as to stand squared, erect, impervious, facing the window open onto the darkening dusk. A student asked me today what my favorite poem was, and I said that it's always the last poem that I wrote, so I'm not going to read you my favorite poem. It's called Annunciation. I feel ashamed, finally, of our magnificent paved roads, our bridges slung with steel, our vivid glass, our tantalizing lights, everything enhanced, rehearsed, a trick. I've turned old. I ache most to be confronted by the real, by the cold, the pitiless, the bleak. by the red fox crossing a field after snow, by the broad shadow scraping past overhead. My young son, eyes set at an indeterminate distance, ears locked, turned inward, caught in some music only he has ever heard. Not our cars, our electronic haze, not the piddling bleats and pings that cause some hearts to race. Ashamed, like a pebble, hard and small, hoping only to be ground to dust by something large and strange and cruel. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. I'd love it if we could have a bit of a conversation. I know there are questions that you've written, but I'd love to hear them.
Well, we're waiting for the questions to come to the front. We've got a few to start with, and we've asked Ms. Smith, and we ask all our writers to recommend three books that they love or they're reading. You've mentioned one of them, which was Look by Solma Sharif. Could you talk a little about, you also list here Claudia Rankine's Citizen. Do you have anything, do you have a sentence or two about that book that
Oh, God, that book is, Citizen is a book of prose poems and visual images from, they're stills from what Claudia Rankine and her husband call situation videos. And it's a book that's thinking about the nature of racism in polite spaces, liberal spaces, among friends and intimates. And it's a book that is really effective at putting you in the position sometimes of the person who is the recipient of this kind of, you know, prejudice, I guess, and also the person who's responsible for it. I think it's a book that moves you around within these situations and I guess makes you feel that we're all complicit in this awful thing. I feel like it's a book, like I said, okay, everybody should read 12 books of poems and 12 books of fiction. If you read this book, then you can just read 11 books of poems and 11 books of fiction. And it's called, its subtitle is An American Lyric, and I feel like she's really creating a portrait with this and her previous book of some of the things that really sadly characterize our lives as Americans and how we do and don't really see and acknowledge each other. So.
And then the last one was Foreign Soil. Can you talk about Maxine Beneba Clark? Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, I think it's Maxine Beneba Clark. She's an Australian writer. Her parents emigrated to Australia in the 70s from Jamaica by way of Britain. And she has this amazing memoir that is thinking about the, you know, experience she had growing up as like the only black person in her schools and her neighborhood and what that felt like at that time in a country that didn't have a vocabulary for difference. She's got a book of short stories called Foreign Soil, where she imagines herself or her characters are immigrants from different parts of the world who are living as outsiders, people who are interpreted, if you will, by others. Sometimes people who interpret each other. There's a story in which a Sudanese second generation immigrant meets a woman who is first generation, and she has a lot of expectations about the way that she's being judged. And, you know, as fiction can do, that is broken down and opened up in a really marvelous way. You know, the immigration crisis that we are in seems like a good reason to read a book that is thinking about all of these different necessities that bring people from one place to another.
Yeah, and there was following on that, there was a question about a writer you referred to earlier. Now it's Yah Jesse, and the book was Homegoing. Is that correct? Okay, good. So that's what that was. You mentioned the phrase encounter with the reader during your talk tonight, and I wondered, do you have the idea of encountering the reader on your mind when you go into writing a poem? Is that something you're thinking about consciously?
I never think about the reader when I'm in the throes of writing anything. And I know it's weird because I know that as a writer, my goal is to have a reader. But the work that I feel like I'm doing is incredibly private, and it's about allowing myself to come up against something that's going to startle me, chasten me, or free me of some kind of anxiety or question, or justify it. And what I believe happens when a poem is realized by the poet is that that discovery is codified in a way, and it is transmitted when and if a reader does arise to the reader. And so for me, that sense of shared experience is, it's like the goal. And maybe I trust that it exists because this is what I feel when I'm reading a great poem. I feel like the speaker of the poem is saying, come here, this happened to me. This is what it felt like. Let's live it again together. And what I experience is this other occurrence and somebody that's kind of this companionable guide to it.
How does writing in received forms, like the sonnet, influence your process and content when you're writing your poems?
I love, when I'm stuck, sometimes I'll turn to received forms because there are requirements. My poem must do certain things if it's going to be a sonnet or if it's going to be a villanelle, and it gives me a roadmap. It also changes what I'm allowed to say, especially if I'm dealing with rhyme, because the natural train of my thought is disrupted by the requirements of sound. And sometimes that's exactly what I need, to go from what comes most naturally to what comes sort of unusually and what might be more accurate or more helpful. So I find myself turning to form when I'm stuck, when I feel like I have a lot to say, but it all wants to come out as a mess. The form can be a great helper. I was going to say it's like Spanx or something for the poem.
Do you see any specific advantage in science fiction, as in 1984? Is 1984 an example of a writer surpassing that genre entirely?
Oh, I think so. Well, I think, what I really think is happening in science fiction, any genre, I think, is just a distancing device. A Western, science fiction. It allows you to think about what is on your mind in the here and now, but from a different remove. So you are saying, I'm worried about xenophobia. I'm worried about how we are caging each other by these really limited notions of who we are and what we want. I don't want to just describe that. What I'm going to do is extrapolate from this tendency now and see what it will look like if it goes unchecked for another 150 years. Where will that leave us? And I feel like that's an incredibly awful reality, usually, that emerges from that kind of exercise. I feel like 1984 feels so like prescient, but really I think it was just a matter of looking closely. I mean, you hear his articulation of his anxieties about what was happening to the English language. I think it's a matter of looking closely at why those things happen and what, if unchecked, they can give way to. And the scary thing is, as we see, he wasn't so far off base.
What's your favorite Bowie song?
I love so much of his music. I'm really partial to the music he was making when I was a baby in the early 70s. So I love the song 5 Years. I feel like that song makes me want to cry a little bit every time I hear it. You know, it's this song that is thinking, or, well, it begins with this statement of, okay, we have 5 years left. The earth is dying. We have 5 years left. And this is a moment when this is being announced on, you know, the nightly news. And it's kind of an elegy, in a way, to our frailty, but also, you know, an acknowledgement of all of the damage that we inflict and the mistakes and who we are, you know, the awful burlesque of human life. That's a poem that I think is so moving. Hmm. A poem, a song.
Who or what has inspired you as a teacher?
Oh, my teachers that I have had, who are just, you know, have been so great. Lucy Brock Broido was my very first teacher, and again, a mentor when I was in graduate school. Lucille Clifton was a teacher, and she spoke so frankly with us about where her poems came from. She had a long period of time in the 70s where almost every day she had a Ouija board session with her children. And she talked about that and how real that felt. And she told us about these poems that came as a result of these messages that came through that. And those poems were published in her last book, Mercy, as this very prophetic sequence called The Message from the Ones, that are imploring humans to love each other and be kind to the planet and understand that we pass through all of these different incarnations that we at one time might fear or hate. It's a really wonderful poem. Other teachers, Mark Doty was a teacher, Henri Cole, people who have just taught me that the conversation around poetry isn't just about making art, but about finding a way of being in the world that's generous and that's reflective. And I feel like that's what I like to try and give to my students, even more than having them think about language.
We have time for just a couple more, but there's a couple in here about how do you know that you're starting a project, or when to start on a project, and how do you know when you're done a project?
I feel like I'm starting a project when the questions I have start to resemble each other, and the sources I turn to have something in common with each other. Then I feel like, okay, there's a kind of critical mass that's, you know, waiting to take shape, and there is a theme I can articulate to myself. And I know I'm finishing the project when I start to recognize that I've covered a little bit of distance. There seems to be an arc that is taking shape within or across poems. Prose is a little bit different. I found myself thinking I was coming up on the end of that memoir over and over again for years, and realizing, no, this is just another draft. So yeah, I don't know. With prose, I need a little help to know when I'm getting close.
Well, and following on that, there's a couple of questions too about the idea that you began as a poet, you've written a memoir. Are you inspired to move on to fiction or theater? Are there other genres that interest you?
Yeah. When I was in school, I was sort of made to believe that I had chosen poetry and I had to remain faithful to poetry only. And now, as a director of a writing program, I know that that is an administrative thing. It's like you got 10 fiction workshops, 10 poetry workshops. People can't keep, you know, running, crossing genres, because then we have to stop and regroup. So I was mistaking that for this sense of, like, devotion to a single form. And then I worked with an older German writer through an arts mentor program, who is a poet and a novelist and a cultural critic, and he invented a poetry machine at one point. And I realized that language is a tool that you can just use in any way you can imagine it. And I wanted to be large like him. And so it felt like one way of doing that would be to learn these other languages, these other forms.
We're going to finish up with a question from a student or a kind of a collect, you know, a summary of a similar statement, which is, what would you say to the students who are here tonight in terms of those who are believe themselves to be young poets? What advice would you leave them with?
Oh, gosh. I have to say the first thing that I always used to think was the boring advice when I was young and asking that question, which is it's really true. You have to read a lot. You have to read all the time. And you have to read in such a way as to sometimes defy your own taste and try and learn from these choices other writers are making. But beyond that, I would say your writing is most interesting not when it is dutifully describing what you already have learned and what you know, but when you're going to a place where you have questions that are unresolved and messy and that are going to cause you to have to rethink everything you thought was true. That's when I think the work is most necessary to you and maybe most rewarding for a reader too. Thank you.
That was Tracy K. Smith speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in March 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks. Join A to Z and help make this podcast and all our programming possible. Give today at literary-arts.org/donate. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.